complete car maintenance, scheduled maintenance, and repair service, including a nationwide warranty by ASE-certified technicians. Located near the U of I campus with shuttle service available. More information is available at 367-0300. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of the Chancellor, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at www.ccfd.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Before we get going here, we would like to say thanks to the 1,225 friends who helped WILL raise over $125,000 during last week's pledge drive. We'd also like to welcome the 204 new friends who came on board during the drive. Your support helps us sustain the programs and the services that you have come to inspect and enjoy. And to you, we want to say thank you very much. Well, in this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the state of journalism in America, some of the problems that beset it and the practice of journalism, and talk a little bit about what, in part at least, what journalism educators are doing to try to better train young reporters. We're talking in this hour of Focus 580 with Nicholas Lemon. He is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He's also a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He has written for a number of publications over his career, including The Washington Monthly, The Texas Monthly, The Washington Post, and The Atlantic Monthly. He's authored several books, including The Promised Land, The Great Black Migration and How It Changed America, was published in 1991, and The Big Test, The Secret History of the American Meritocracy, that was published in 1999. He'll be spending some time on the campus of the University of Illinois later this week. He'll be giving a talk in the Millercom series titled Journalism and Social Science. This will be on Thursday at 7:30 in the evening in room 100 of Gregory Hall on the U of I campus. It's given in conjunction with the donation of the Leon Dash papers to the university archives, honoring Leon Dash, who's a member of the Journalism Factory, faculty, maybe also faculty of the University of Illinois. The talk is free and open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. So again, that's Thursday night on the U of I campus. Here this morning during the program, questions and comments from people who are listening are also welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local folks. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call is that they just try to be brief in their comments so that we can get in as many people as possible, keep the program moving along. Mr. Lemon, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. I thought I'd begin by making reference to a couple of recent surveys having to do with people's attitudes toward the news media. And I'm sure you're familiar with these and other people will be too. For example, a couple of years ago in 2003, the Pew Research Center for People in the Press, they found that 66% of Americans see the news reports as slanted. And that's up from 53% in 1985. They also found 32% believe that news organizations were immoral, up from 13% in 1985. Here's one, the Harris people. In the 70s, 25 to 30% of Americans said they had a great deal of confidence in the press, more than they had in Congress, in unions, or in American corporations. However, in a poll just this year, the press ranked only ahead of law firms. Just 12% said they had high confidence in the media. One more here, also one from Pew, found Trends 2005 found 45% of Americans said they believe little or nothing of what they read in their daily papers. That's up from 16% two decades ago. So obviously, the one thing we know is that Americans do have mood swings as far as their feelings about media are concerned. But things now seem to be pretty bad. I don't know if this is as bad as they've ever been, but pretty bad. Why do you think it is that so many Americans have such a low opinion of the news media?
Well, I'm trying not to say the truth hurts. at least you could say that about both the public and the press. Here's what I think is going on, although I can't claim to know exactly what's going on. The first thing is we're in a period when there have been some very high-profile sort of scandals inside the press, and I guess the number one would be the Jason Blair scandal at the Times now 2.5 years ago, where, you know, revered institutions have been revealed to have within them rogue actors who do embarrassing things, and it tends to sort of tear down the reputation of our business. The other thing is there's much more talk about the press than there used to be, mostly because of the advent of the Internet. And I think this is, you know, a healthy thing for the Republic and for the press in particular, but it's just true and noticeable that if you're a journalist, you know, used to be when I was starting out, you'd publish your work and that would kind of be it, or maybe there'd be a letter to the editor that would arrive in the mail 2 weeks later. Now when you publish something on an important topic, in ways that are sometimes gratifying and sometimes not, there's just this kind of instant commentary about it. It's you feel like a politician or something, because there's all these people on the web discussing your work. And if you slip up at all, it will be pointed out instantly in a way that wasn't true not very long ago. And I think as a result of this, you know, the kind of press we're talking about here, I guess you'd say, is a form of authority. And it's a form of authority that's increasingly being questioned for political reasons, for technological reasons, for economic and cultural reasons, and that kind of sinks in. So that's, I think that's why what's happening is happening. What I haven't said, and what I don't think, is that the press itself has changed in any meaningful way just recently. I think it's much more stuff going on outside the press than stuff inside the press that's responsible for this.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that we could really expect that reporters would never make mistakes, honest mistakes. And if that's so, that's fine that they be pointed out. They should be pointed out. The news organization should acknowledge them, mm-hmm. and so forth. Although there's a difference between that and, for example, a case like Jason Blair.
Right.
Do you think that it is the case that somehow there is any more malfeasance in the profession than there has been before?
I don't think so. It's hard for me to tell because of where I sit. I have had the good fortune to work continuously since 1978 for magazines that had very elaborate fact-checking systems. So I've never been in an environment where you could be a Jason Blair, you'd get caught like 5 seconds later. And that's you know, I have a lot of first-hand experience in journalism, but that is my first-hand experience. So I don't know whether, you know, big city newsrooms have gotten more loose in the way they operate than they used to. I suspect not. I suspect they haven't gotten more loose. If anything has happened, and again, you know, I don't have hard data on this, only impressions. What daily newspapers do, and to some extent television news organizations as well, their compact with their audience has changed somewhat. We don't just deliver the facts of what happened yesterday anymore because people have other ways to get that. So what newspapers are giving people is a more a product that's more ambitious. And reporters are being called on to do more ambitious things in their work than just report the facts of an event that are undisputed. And that can lead, I suppose, to more mistakes. But I really think that the biggest change is not conduct of journalists, but the kind of regulatory, informal regulatory system on journalism is much, much more vibrant and active than it was when I started out in the business.
Yeah. Let me ask you one more question, then we have a caller I'll get to. I want to promise that I won't make them wait forever. The one thing that seems to run through some of these recent high-profile scandals, the Jason Blair thing, and now some of the controversy surrounding Judith Miller in the New York Times, one of the things that seems to run through them is criticism of the kind of oversight of reporters and their work by editors. Do you think that somehow that editors aren't doing their jobs?
Well, again, you know, I speak from this kind of privileged position of having spent most of my career working for magazines that are relatively small and where, you know, the kind of thing we've been reading about is pretty impossible. I mean, I was covering Louis Libby myself, you know, in 2002 and 2003, and, you know, when I talked to people at that level, it was always under very close supervision by my editors, and they knew exactly when I was walking into his office and when I was leaving and what he had said to me. Newspapers are so big that they have laxer controls on their writers. And there's, you know, both the Jason Blair and the Judith Miller cases, you're seeing the result of reporters in a system that operates on trust and fairly loose supervision, and who, for reasons of their own personalities, are very good at exploiting that and kind of act completely independently. And that should end. I think you'll see, I would be almost certain you'd see at the New York Times and probably at other news organizations, a lot more kind of accountability, a kind of shorter leash for working reporters, a lot less of a feeling of, you know, every reporter can just go out there and do whatever they want and we'll trust them. I think that'll happen almost certainly. It probably should happen.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Nicholas Lemon. He's dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He also writes for The New Yorker magazine. He'll be here in Champaign-Urbana on Thursday to talk about journalism and social justice, and is talking with us here this morning about journalism in America today. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have someone start with listening in Sycamore up in northern Illinois, northwestern Illinois. Line number one. Hello.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Hi.
I have two comments for your guest that I would like his thoughts on them.
Sure.
About journalism in general. One is there's a lack of follow-up on a lot of major stories. One major one in point that will, you know, be recognized by all, I think, is the McDonald's coffee lawsuit, where it was widely publicized that the plaintiff in that case was awarded $2.7 million in damages for spilling coffee on herself. And you've never heard the final result, which was that yes, the person was actually very severely burned and has sustained major medical bills, which McDonald's refused to cover until they were sued, at which point they... you know, of course, were awarded punitive or hit with punitive damages. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing really wound up settling for about $600,000. And none of that was covered in, you know, certainly given the publicity that the original settlement was. So, you know, I claim that a lot of journalism, you know, covers the spectacular start of the story and then never follows up. And you're left wondering whatever happened. And the other case is particularly in television news reporting. Most of what they report on the evening 10 o'clock news isn't really news. It's murders and accidents. And really what's more important, I think, is what's going on in Springfield and what our government is up to. So I'll hang up and listen to your comments unless you have some questions. Go ahead.
Well... The lack of follow-up is just true. I agree with the caller. That is a real problem in journalism. It's hard to solve. And I'll just give a number of examples of it. The reason it's hard to solve is, let's take the example of a daily newspaper. You know, what a daily newspaper is promising, as I mentioned before, the promise is changing pretty significantly now. But historically, it says, we're going to give you a report on what happened yesterday in the world. You know, we add some things, but that's basically what we're in business to do. Like any institution, a daily newspaper has limited resources. And so, you know, the person who is covering, say, the McDonald's coffee spill story, you know, that in almost any news organization that writes about it, that person is going to be assigned to that topic for a period of several hours, and that's it. In an ideal world, the news organization should say, stay on that and spend a significant part of your time, you know, following up what happens with it. But nobody has the staff size really to stay on any more than just a few things. I mean, just one of the most sort of shocking examples is the way in which people don't cover government anymore. There's some number, I don't want to quote it because I'll get it wrong, of how many full-time reporters there are in Sacramento, California, covering the California state government, which is, you know, bigger than all but a handful of national governments in the world, but it's tiny. Even the biggest news organizations in Washington don't have anybody full-time covering federal agencies, for example. And then the other thing that happens is, you know, as people often note about journalism, when events get on the front page and things that are follow-ups that aren't events get buried in the paper, so even if you do follow up, nobody notices. I don't have a good structural solution to this problem other than that we should try to do a better job. But it's to be honest with you, it is a problem, and it's not one where there's some simple, uncostly thing you can do that will fix it.
The other point that the caller raised, and I think as he says, this is the question, the criticism that is most often leveled at television news, particularly local, but you also see it in big cities, and it may in fact be worse in some bigger cities. That's the old, you know, people have, I'm sure, heard the phrase, if it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
That what they tend to do is focus on high-profile and crimes, car accidents, fires, those kinds of things, often, particularly if they have good pictures to go with them, and that that the perhaps the more serious or the important news, it could be in city government, it could be in state government, and it's likely that if you see any kind of national, international news, it might be a 40-second roundup, which is simply just a headline summary, and then they go on to whatever else they're doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I hate to tell you, but you know why that happens. It's all about economics. Most journalists would love to cover the more serious, substantive stuff and not the, you know, grisly car accidents and so on. But that's what gets ratings, and the higher ratings bring in advertising dollars, and it's just a very, very simple explanation of why that happens. Places, other countries where it doesn't happen, have very differently structured broadcast systems where, you know, they tend to be either state-owned or partly state-owned, very heavily regulated. And, you know, in this country, we adopted a private system. Although it was very heavily regulated for decades, and in the last, say, two decades has become much less regulated, and the result of that is more sensationalism. And you know, it's a structural problem that you can't get out of unless you do things that journalists are very uncomfortable talking about, like regulate the press more heavily, at least that portion of it.
Recently, several major papers, one of them being the New York Times, announced significant layoffs, and they said that they're having a difficult time competing these days with all of the other sources of news. Uh-huh. Readership is going down, and that that's simply they're having to bow to economic realities by reducing staff, and that hardly, you can hardly imagine that by staff reductions you're going to put out a better product. And now, of course, there's also has been a lot of talk in these organizations about the fact that this is an opportunity for us to reinvent ourselves to be something new. I don't know what exactly that would be, but I guess I'm wondering what you think about some of the economic pressures that are coming to bear on news organizations and what that might be likely to mean for the product.
Well, first of all, the Times held out for a very long time on layoffs, and excuse me, hadn't done them for a long time and did a fairly small layoff. And I think in the announcement of it, they were a little less existentially gloomy about everything they do than you're saying they are. But your point is a fair one. The big picture of what's going on in journalism is this. It's a couple of things. First of all, some of what you're seeing with these layoffs is what you're seeing, you know, in almost every big organization in America, whether or not it's in journalism, and I'm sure this will resonate with many of your listeners, and that is the kind of post-World War II compact of people who worked for large organizations that they would, you know, have lifetime employment or de facto lifetime employment, that they would have, you know, essentially unlimited health benefits, that they would get raises every year, that they would have so-called defined benefit pensions. That's just gone for a bunch of reasons that have nothing to do with journalism. But it's affecting news organizations as it's affecting, you know, automakers and tool and die makers and everybody else. So that's part of what you're seeing with these newsroom layoffs. The other thing is, you know, newspapers are in transition. Most people in the business will tell you, at least privately, that they believe that the delivery form for their organization in a generation or even less will be the internet, not, you know, newsprint delivered to your house. And they're trying to figure out how to go through the transition from, you know, paper delivery to internet delivery. And this is a difficult moment. In some ways, it's very promising because the internet is a really powerful, wonderful tool for getting information in people's hands. But the economics of it don't work for traditional news organizations in most cases yet. And, you know, so you're seeing the old system where the economics did work losing audience, not rapidly, but steadily, the internet gaining audience but not having an economic model that has been shown to work as well, and big news organizations are kind of caught in the middle. They're in this difficult period when, you know, they're transitioning from print to internet, and the economics on both sides aren't very good right now.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller in Indiana on our line 4 toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Unfortunately, it is such a general problem. It's like punching a 12-foot balloon. You punch it one place and doesn't really do much to it. The questions in regard, I remember as a youngster, my grandfather used to diligently read the Chicago Tribune. And as I remember, he would make comments aside to me, and I picked up a lot of information. That information now is only available if you have a fair amount of money and can, or have a damn good library in a town where you can go to different types of distribution. Like on the left, you would have certain magazines and journals that would give their view, and on the right, you would have that grouping. And on the internet, you have a group like the Free Press, you know, then you have the people who find out mistakes are made, and just recently, on the station there, they had a person when I think it was Mr. McChesney's program. They sort out the stories that the larger press does not cover for one reason or another. One can keep, you know, busy almost 24 hours a day keeping up to things where we used to have that more or less in one little bundle, and the same problem would occur on the internet too. Plus, the problem for people who can't afford, in a sense, the purchase of the computer and the modem and paying the charges per month and things like that. In a sort of a unsubtle way, I like to push it to the people on Wall Street. And I guess the main model for that is the HMOs, where all of a sudden people were making decisions about what drugs you could have simply because of the expense, and that was caused in the long run by the people on Wall Street wanting to make sure that there was always some kind of increase in profits from the HMOs. And, of course, we've been through that a number of times, and it still occurs as far as that goes. And those problems, you know, basically fall around capitalism. And however you want to go at it. That's the problem. Thanks.
Well, I think realistically, you know, capitalism is here to stay in the United States, and so we're going to have to figure out a capitalist solution to this problem. It breaks my heart somewhat to hear journalism discussed so much as a thing that cannot be supported by market forces, and I hope that's not true. In the good old days that the caller was talking about when his father subscribed to the Chicago Tribune, you know, I would guess that you know, if you held everything constant, what his father was spending to get the Chicago Tribune delivered was a pretty significant amount of money. So it wasn't, you know, free information. Today, and this is part of the problem that we were talking about a minute ago with newsroom layoffs and so on, because of the internet, people, the audience has been unwilling relatively to pay for information and is actually getting a lot more information free than was ever possible before. News organizations would like that to change over time because, you know, otherwise they'll have to let go everybody who works for them as a reporter. So, you know, the answer to the problem, I think, is to build audiences around different news organizations that are willing to pay for information at a level that supports real reporting. Because if they're not, I don't know where the support is going to come from. Mm.
I guess I would, in a respectful sort of way, I would question the point that the caller made, or suggesting that at any time one newspaper could have provided you with all of the news that you needed to know. And they do still on the front page of the New York Times say all the news that's fit to print. But I don't think that anybody imagines now or perhaps ever that that was all the news.
Well, yeah, and I mean, also, those of us who remember, I'm guessing the caller's talking about the Chicago Tribune in the days of 40, 50 years ago. I suspect, first of all, the Tribune is publishing more column inches of news now than it was then. And second of all, my predecessor, the New Yorker, A.J. Liebling, used to make fun of the Tribune of that time relentlessly and often for good reason as, you know, a very biased product. So it's always tempting to think in any realm of life things were better in the past and now they're worse. I suspect just in terms of the average citizen without any money's ability to get access to information, things are probably better now than they were, you know, a generation or two ago.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me introduce again the guest for this hour. We're talking with Nicholas Lemon. He is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. He is also staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and over his career as a journalist has written for a number of different publications, including The Washington Monthly, The Texas Monthly, The Washington Post, and The Atlantic Monthly. He is going to be here in Champaign-Urbana near the end of the week on Thursday to give a talk in the Millercom series. The talk is on journalism and social justice. Thursday, 7:30 in the evening, room 100 of Gregory Hall on the U of I campus. That's on Wright Street. And these are events are always open to the public and free to anyone who would like to attend. Questions here also this morning as we talk about journalism and reporting. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up, nearby community, Belgium, line number 2. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to discuss with your guest the aspect that how can I explain it? Back at the turn of the 20th century, famous physician by the name of Heisenberg observed that whenever you observe something, you change it, especially in the subatomic level. Well, the same thing seems to be true with various media, not only newspapers, but radio and television and everything. You observe the facts, but in the aspect of observing these facts, they change. They're not static. They move around. They're very hard to hold on to. And they vary over how many times they're reported, the way they're reported, sometimes good, sometimes bad, some that may be done for the most noble of reasons or not. But how do you handle that aspect of relaying the facts of life, or the occurrences of life, maybe I should say more than the facts?
Well, that's a big question. I know what you mean. I've been a reporter for, God, how many years? 33 years. I do know what you mean. And now, you know, I have an administrative position in an organization, and in the course of doing that, I get reported on. And so I know what you mean even more. But I guess in the end, I think as a reporter, you can offer a surely imperfect but basically accurate and useful version of the facts of the situation. Everything is relative, and reporters are never going to get things 100% right, but you're a hell of a lot better off, better informed, if a good reporter has gone out and looked at a situation than if you didn't have any information other than what the organization itself tells you about itself. It's that kind of independent check that is, although imperfect, I think quite useful.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's go on. Peoria, next caller, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, your guest is certainly at the top of one of the best schools of journalism in the U.S., so I'm very interested in this. I have a couple of comments, and I'd like to hear what his reply would be.
Mm-hmm.
The first is, the U.S. press, it seems to me, has such a lopsided coverage of Israel and the Palestinian situation that...
Which side do you think it's lopsided on?
Oh, toward Israel.
Uh-huh.
That's why I read a couple of Israeli news media. I think I get a much more objective view of what's going on there and how the Israelis are treating the Palestinians than I do when I read the American papers. Just to give you an example, one of my neighbors is an Israeli who came over here and now teaches at one of the universities here. And I mentioned to him that I particularly liked a columnist named Amira Haas.
Oh, yeah, I know her.
You know her?
Mm-hmm.
He said, she's great. She's a survivor of the Holocaust, and they can't touch her. So I think when I read Haaretz, for example, they are much more objective in their coverage than the U.S. media. The other comment I'd make is, when I listen to BBC reporters questioning various political figures, it seems to me they're much more aggressive than our American reporters. They follow up much more vigorously than do American reporters. I'd be interested in your comments.
Well, on the first one, it's such a broad statement that it's hard for me to take sides on, because there's a lot of internal variation in the press. Anybody who's an editor of a newspaper in a big city, I think, will tell you that by far the one issue they get the most feedback about from readers is the coverage of Israel and Palestine. And the feedback tends to consist of Jewish groups saying that you're biased against Israel, and Arab American groups saying that you're biased against the Palestinians. So most of my friends who are newspaper editors privately just sort of throw up their hands and say there's no pleasing these people, because it's the two sides. Basic vision of the reality of the situation is just non-intersecting. You know, there are particular reporters who tend to come under fire from both sides, because editors hear from both sides so often in this situation. They tend to be very careful. I agree with you that by looking at someplace like Haaretz, it's surprising how much more diversity of opinion there is in Israel than there is among American friends of Israel. But I don't agree that the American press as a whole is overwhelmingly biased on the Israel side of the conflict. And can you remind me of the second question?
Well, the other question, he must no doubt listen to the BBC on the radio. We carry a lot of BBC material here, and there are other public stations who do. And his observation was, and I think I have seen the same, that in the BBC, reporters and correspondents in their questioning of people that they're interviewing tend to be quite a bit more aggressive than do American reporters.
Yeah, we'd like to be. I mean, maybe I'm making excuses here, but most myself and most of my colleagues feel that that's because of, you know, the way that the administration operates its press conferences. I don't think generally that American reporters are less aggressive in their questioning, but, you know, the place where you get the closest direct look at this is the White House. And President Bush has very few press conferences. He tends, when he does, not to call on people known to be aggressive questioners. It's very hard to actually do that because of the way these events are conducted in the United States.
Just to pick up on, you know, the caller made reference to your being at one of the most highly thought of schools of journalism here in the United States. Given that there are all these criticisms of reporters, and we have a couple of other callers, I'm sure we'll hear more, and given the fact that clearly people in the news business are also concerned about their lack of credibility and the public perception, how, as a journalism educator, how do you get at those issues, and are you thinking about doing something differently than you have been doing in the past, as you take young people who want to be reporters and try to help them learn how to do that?
Yes, a lot. I mean, first of all, journalism school is a kind of ideal perch from which to contemplate and discuss the profession. And we do that, you know, we have 120 public events at the school every year, all of which are devoted to some sort of critique of some aspect of journalism. So I often feel like we must be the world headquarters of journalism criticism. We publish a magazine that comes out 6 times a year. We operate a daily website of press criticism with a full staff. So we're having this discussion, you know, 24/7 in this building from which I'm speaking to you. In addition, this year we've started at our school a new degree program, which is our first new professional degree that we've offered in 71 years. And it's I teach in it myself. It's focused on making reporters more expert in specific subjects and generally better at dealing with, you know, complicated material. And we hope that will really have an effect on the field in terms of producing journalism that is, you know, more richly informative, less, you know, directed toward conflict and personality, more substantive, more accurate. So we're you know, moving very forcefully in this area.
So this is a kind of discussion that I think has been going on in journalism schools and universities probably for a long time. That is, if you're training reporters, what would be more important, that they major in journalism and that you teach them about writing and about everything that goes with that? Or would it be better if they actually major in something like economics or
Right. Well, we're doing a version of that. I mean, first of all, we're a graduate school, so we don't have, you know, everybody who comes to us has already been to college and majored in something. And it's usually not journalism. And then the way our school is structured, you know, we have our venerable degree program, Master of Science degree, teaches mainly journalism skills. And then our new degree program, MA program, which sequences after the MS, teaches, you know, in-depth subject matter knowledge specifically tailored to journalists who don't have specialized training in those areas. So you can come to us and say, I'm a general assignment reporter, and I want to learn a lot about economics or about the arts or about science, and we can teach you that in this new program.
Well, we have about 15
and
minutes left.
I should say also, you know, if you come to us and say the opposite, I'm a scientist, and all I want to do is learn how to be a journalist, we can also do that for you. So, mm-hmm. so we can answer both sets of needs, the needs of people who feel they really need journalism skills and the needs of people who have journalism skills but feel they don't have the ability to grapple with a complicated subject.
Our guest, Nicholas Lemon, he is dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University and also continues to be a staff writer for The New Yorker. We have about 10, a little bit more minutes left in this part of Focus. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here on a cell phone, line 2. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
It appears that a lot of reporters are unwilling to burn an anonymous source even when they lie to them. Why do you think that is?
An anonymous source who lied to them?
Mm-hmm. They'll still, you know, instead of, you know, saying, this source, you know, is not, we're going to name this source because they obviously fed us wrong information for political, economic, whatever reasons.
Well, from the reporter, I mean, first of all, you know, in this now the case about the White House leaks that is everyone's paying attention to, all the reporters ended up naming their sources, it should be noted, or the sources.
Only under pressure.
Yeah, under pressure. But I'll give you the argument, which, and I'm not just giving it for the sake of arguments because I believe in it. If you're talking to anonymous sources, the first thing you say going in is, I promise you anonymity. So you've made that person a promise, and you have to keep the promise. If
that's right. You've made a bond of trust with them. And
okay, but wait, let
trust,
me, hear me out, hear me out.
Okay.
So if the person ended up lying to you, it doesn't, it, to my mind, dissolve the promise you made to them. You can't then say all bets are off because that's like saying, well, you know, you broke your word, so I'm going to break my word. What I would rather say to a source is, you broke your word, but I don't break my word under any circumstances, so I'm going to keep my word to you even though you lied to me. One other point about these relations with anonymous sources is very important and hard for outsiders to see. You know, and I alluded to this when an earlier caller called. The truth is gettable, but not without struggle. And almost any situation that you cover that has any complexity at all, the truth of it is in dispute. So the line, you know, sometimes a source very clearly lies to you. But most of the time, you'll find that, you know, it's like Citizen Kane, if you've ever seen that, or the story of the blind man and the elephant. You'll talk to a bunch of sources, and each has a slightly different version of what happened. And your job as a reporter is to do the best you can, sorting it out and trying to be a kind of honest broker and determine the best you can do on what really happened. So you almost never get, quote-unquote, the truth from one source. You're almost always getting a kind of interested version of what happened from the source. That's the rule. It's relatively uncommon to get outright lies from a source. But again, I think if you promise the person, you didn't say, unless you said at the outset, I am promising you anonymity conditional on everything you're saying to me, you're going to say to me being true, you have to keep your promise of anonymity no matter what the truth of what they told you turns out to be.
Well, then they need to go in saying that. You need to tell me. You tell me an outright lie. You're burned. That's it. You're out.
Yeah, I don't do that. I don't think, for the reason I just said, I don't do that, and I don't think it's fair to do that.
Not even to an outright lie.
Not even to an outright lie, because, again, it's all about a promise I made to the source. I looked the source in the eye and said, I will treat you as anonymous, I promise. I didn't say, I will treat you as anonymous, but if it turns out you lied to me, I will burn you. If I said that at the outset, then it's okay. But the promise I made was that I would keep them anonymous no matter what. So I have to keep my promise.
well, that's good for the past, and let's look to the future. Where should they go now?
Yeah, I just don't think we agree about this.
Well, possibly. What about stenographer reporting? Reporters who don't have the background to be able to challenge a source on the facts.
Well,
and they
you know,
report what they're told.
At Columbia, we're trying to change that by, you know, as I mentioned, offering this very ambitious new degree program that teaches reporters to be unafraid of the substance of a situation. Having said that, you know, good reporters aren't stenographers, and often you're writing about a situation where you don't know what really happened, and it's very hard to tell what really happened. So you go around and talk to a lot of different people and gather as much information as you can. That you are not able in the first interview to challenge the person on what they told you happened is built into the process, and it doesn't mean you're a stenographer when you're sort of sitting there in the interview nodding and writing down what they said. It means you're thinking, I'm going to go double-check this with somebody else later.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I got one more I want to make sure we try and get, and we're getting very short on time. The next caller is in Urbana, and it's line number 3.
Hi, how are you?
Yes, hi.
Very interesting. In a way, I said that when I listen to other callers, it always seems to me like this is a shoot the messenger deal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not happy with the content of the message, so it's obviously the messenger's fault, not my ability to determine through some skeptical inquiry good dose of skepticism that says, well, you know, could this possibly be true other than something really obvious like a car accident or something? But it seems to me like a lot of the people that I've noticed want to be spoon-fed everything, and they don't want to think about anything. So aren't they getting what they deserve then? You know what I mean? Like, are they getting, like, entertainment? I mean, if you watch television news, it's basically interspersed between entertainment and or infotainment, as someone said once. But I don't know. I think that reporters, are, you know, like you come from a very, you know, prestigious school, and I think a lot of reporters really just try hard. Or I mean, you know, and they want to find the truth, whatever that is. I mean, you know, the object. I think more an objective fact. I mean, or facts. But it just strikes me as kind of odd that everybody attacks the reporters, attacks the media, and yet, you know, like you said, very, very interestingly. This is a time when you can find information at a level that is unprecedented. I mean, if you aren't willing to go out and say, well, I don't believe that guy, I'll find out some alternative source, then can't you? Nobody wants to blame themselves for being gullible enough to believe this stuff or whatever. I don't know. It just really bothers me.
Well, I guess, you know, as I said, I've been doing this a long time, and I'm pretty used to it by now.
Yeah.
It's true that you rarely run across anyone who isn't a journalist who says, hey, I just simply love journalists and admire what they do. We tend to be bearers of bad news, and we tend to be unpopular because of that, but that's, you know, that's our job.
Yeah, and I mean, if you don't like, I mean, turn the message off, but I just find it real interesting that most of the people have been calling in and just complaining over and over again about the guy that did this or they're not following up on that. I think, well, there's, you know, you can follow up on your own. I mean, there's enough media outlets, not just television and print, but there's the internet is hugely, I mean, you can find out just about anything on the internet if you're,
right.
Well, and you got to be skeptical, but of course you have to have skepticism too, but then, okay. Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, just for a minute or two, and that's about all the time we have left, to stay with the issue of the use of anonymous sources. This does seem to be something with a lot of people, a lot of individuals, a sore point or a point of concern, that is the use by reporters of anonymous sources.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that somehow the way that reporters do this needs to change?
That's a tough one. I mean, you know, several news organizations, notably the New York Times, Washington Post, and Newsweek, have recently instituted regimes where you're not allowed to use anonymous sources unless you say why they want to be anonymous. And what you find is that they still use anonymous sources a lot, and they essentially just say, a source said, quote, this, unquote, requesting anonymity because he or she works at the White House and you're not supposed to talk about these things in the White House. It's sort of stating the obvious. it's a strength of the American press that we're so wildly competitive with each other. And anonymous sources, you know, are relied on very heavily by the press because it's a way to compete successfully with other news organizations by kind of getting information that people would not be willing to give if they had their names attached to them. You'd have to have all the journalists at once sort of take the pledge that we no longer want exclusive stories beating the competition in order to forswear the use of anonymous sources. In my own work, I try to use them as little as possible. But you just, you know, you constantly get pressured to use them because of the hope that anonymity will pry loose a little more information.
Well, we're at the point that we're going to have to finish here for this first hour of the show. However, I want to again tell people who are here in Champaign-Urbana where we are that our guest, Nicholas Lemon, will be talking on the topic journalism and social justice as part of the Millicom series. This is Thursday night, 7:30, room 100 of Gregory Hall. That's on Wright Street on the U of I campus. These are programs are always open to anyone who is interested. And if you'd like to hear more from him, you should certainly stop by. He is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. You can also see his writing in the New Yorker magazine. He is author of a couple of books, several books, including The Promised Land, The Great Black Migration and How It Changed America, and also The Big Test, The Secret History of the American Meritocracy. Mr. Lemon, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Programming here on WILL is made possible in part by the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, presenting Rave On from November 11th through the 13th and 18th through the 20th. Billy McGeegan steps on stage as music legend Buddy Holly, taking the audience back to the good old days of rock and roll with such Rockin' in the Aisles classics as That'll Be the Day, Peggy Sue, and Chantilly Lace. To get information at 1-888-261-9675. Focus 580, this program also made possible with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. In the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Israeli journalist Yossi Halevi. He's Israeli correspondent for The New Republic. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. We'll be with us in the next hour. First, though, we'll break. We'll have news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at trade at the Chicago Board of Trade.